I think there's going to be a team that values, you know, not only being nearly 7 feet tall and being able to check some of the more imposing centers in the league, but that value the story too. That's kind of cool.
So will the NBA's first openly gay player change the story of professional sports? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also this week, one doctor explains what happens when a company has a monopoly on certain kinds of genetic information and takes it out of the public domain.
And now I've introduced a huge amount of worry into this patient's mind without being able to satisfy it one way or the other. I just don't think that's the way I want to practice medicine.
And Cyndi Lauper talks about pretty much everything, including her life in the music biz.
They used to say to me, well, what the hell is that you're wearing? Why can't you wear jeans and a t-shirt like Katrina and the Waves? I'd be like, oh my God.
That's all coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. With sports, most notably the coming out of Washington Wizards center Jason Collins in the pages of Sports Illustrated, the first male player to come out while actively playing on a major league team. Some have worried about professional blowback, but in the coverage so far, it seems like a slam dunk, drawing cheers from fellow players.
The conversations that are going on in our locker rooms and all over the country, I think it's a beautiful thing.
Coaches.
I respect his decision, but quite frankly, I'm just focusing on game four.
And even a particularly prominent amateur.
He seems like a terrific young man, and yeah, I told him I couldn't be prouder of him.
ESPN reporter Kevin Arnovitz, who also happens to be gay, says the story is only beginning.
The announcement is the easy part. The really hard work is going to be sharing a locker room with guys who may be at various levels of discomfort. Teammates getting tired that every time they go into a road city, it's, hey, look, Jason Collins is in town. Let's ask all his teammates. What's it been like having the first openly gay teammate?
It's certainly generated a lot of tolerant-sounding conversation from sports people, but also it seems fear on the part of the less tolerant that they won't be tolerated. On ESPN, commentator Chris Broussard said that living openly in unrepentant sin, and that includes living gay, is walking in open rebellion to God and Jesus.
There are a lot of Christians in the NBA, and they don't want to be, just because they disagree with that lifestyle, they don't want to be viewed and called bigoted and intolerant.
And LZ Granderson, who's an openly gay columnist for ESPN, acknowledged that cries of homophobia may inhibit conversation.
I'm not one that wants to stranglehold a respectable conversation because someone disagrees with me.
The sports news and gossip blog Deadspin said that ESPN had reduced the story to a piece of sellable controversy lying equidistant between two claims. Chris Broussard arguing the bigot's perspective, said Deadspin, LG Granderson arguing the other side. I'm just wondering whether or not you agree with Deadspin that in creating two poles, you create a false equality between a position of tolerance and a position of intolerance.
I don't think that's what happened, Brooke. I think what happened is this. Chris Broussard is one of our leading NBA insiders. Probably has more numbers on his phone, more insight into the minds of players, coaches, etc., than, you know, almost anybody in our organization. He happens to also be a very observant guy in terms of biblical literalism or what have you. But he wasn't brought on there for his positions. He was brought on there because, you know, when you want to find out, you know, what are players thinking about, what coaches are thinking about, you go to those who are well-sourced. If one of them happens to have a very particular religious posture, that comes with the package. It's not always convenient, but that's what conversation's about. And I think LZ would agree with that and essentially did.
Are there any voices that we haven't yet heard from that you're waiting for?
Yeah. And I don't know that we're going to. There are a lot of young basketball players in the league who are not going to be comfortable right off. I think these are also young guys who've grown up with Twitter, have seen the effects of social media and know best to keep their mouth shut. Now, you might have certain people say, well, That's political correctness speaking. No, I think it's an understanding that their discomfort is not necessarily the majority view, and they know better than to generate distractions, generate heat, and most of them don't want to have to face down a media corps. This is fundamentally a workplace issue. One of the tasks is going to be for the teams to help guys reconcile a religious belief system with the workplace environment that needs to exist for everyone to be able to flourish, including people like Jason Collins.
I think it's interesting how the historic part of this, the first working male major league athlete, etc., has become less prominent in the coverage than Jason's own story and his talent currently as an athlete. I mean, he's on the older side. His stats haven't been particularly good in recent years. Some have even waggishly suggested that, you know, this might contribute to his getting another contract.
And by the way, it might contribute to his getting another contract. You know, I talked to one executive who said, listen, basketball is about winning ball games, and you want to assemble a roster of people who are going to help you win ball games. But when you start filling out a roster, you want character guys, they're called, in the league. And I think there are going to be teams that do want a Jason Collins around. This has been a parlor game for NBA reporters the last few days. Had someone asked you a week ago to approximate the chances that Jason Collins would be on an opening night NBA roster this upcoming fall, I think a lot of us would have said 50-60%. I do think there are enough owners in the NBA that value him not only being nearly 7 feet tall and being able to check some of the more imposing centers in the league, but that value that and frankly might value the story too. Think about it in terms of the media context. If you're his next team, it's certainly an opportunity for an organization to really kind of fly the flag of progress.
Like the Dodgers.
And I think history has treated the Dodgers very well. You could be that team.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Arnovitz covers the NBA for ESPN. It's hard to discuss breaking down barriers in sports without, at least once, invoking the Brooklyn Dodgers. Specifically, Jackie Robinson, who broke Major League Baseball's color barrier 66 years ago this month. His story is the stuff of legend, as in the new film named for his number, 42.
You want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back?
No, I want a player who's got the guts not to fight back.
Robinson's legend took shape and took off from the very start.
You give me a uniform, you give me a number on my back, and I'll give you the guts.
Just 3 years after his debut as a player, he starred as himself in the Jackie Robinson story.
Suppose I collide with you at second base, and when I get up, I say, you dirty black so-and-so, what do you do?
Mr. Rickey, do you want a ball player who's afraid to fight back?
I want a ball player with guts enough not to fight back.
Throughout the more than six-decade celebration over Robinson's achievement, the chief interpreter of it, the strong and steady hand behind both the man and the myth, is virtually unknown. Los Angeles Times sports writer Bill Plaschke has recently penned a portrait of this largely invisible man.
When he was 17 years old, he played in a really important baseball game, and a scout came, and he was the pitcher, and there was a white catcher, and a scout came and said, you know, I'd like to sign you to play for professional baseball, but you're black, I can't do it, so he signed the white catcher instead. From that moment on, Wendell Smith said that he was going to try to break the racial barriers in baseball, however way he could do it, and he couldn't do it by playing, so he decided to do it by writing. So he was a sports writer who was also an advocate. So it was Wendell Smith who first came to Branch Rickey, the Dodgers general manager, and said, hey, I got a guy you should look at to be the first black in baseball, and that's Jackie Robinson. Branch Rickey decided that Jackie would be the best candidate to break the barrier. One of the first people he called was Wendell Smith, and he said, listen, we want you to travel with him. So they traveled together for the first 2 years of Jackie's pro career. It would be unthinkable today for a newspaper to allow a writer to accompany just one player all the time and take care of him.
He ghost wrote Robinson's weekly newspaper column.
Yeah, he was his voice. He would also counsel Robinson on how to deal with the media. And okay, they're going to ask you this, you need to say this.
You wrote that when Robinson resisted, Smith would remind him that he himself was enduring the same racial slights, only without the stardom.
That was the most, to me, the most compelling part of the movie, which mirrored real life exactly from my research, was where Wendell picked up Jack at the train station, and Jack's like, Wendell, I get tired of you. You're always with me. You're always trying to counsel me. You have no idea what I'm going through. And Wendell stopped the car and looked at him and said, Jack, why do you think I sit in the stands at games? Why do you think I type my stories with a typewriter on my knees in the bleachers? Why don't you think I'm in a press box? Because I'm not allowed in a press box. Because I go through the same stuff you do. Open your eyes. Can't imagine as a sports writer not having access to a place to write your story. I can't imagine that. He had to cover the team a whole year before the Baseball Writers Association of America even let, you know, Wendell join.
In the Courier, the black paper for which Wendell was still writing even as he was traveling with Robinson, he encouraged black fans to conduct themselves well at games, and he downplayed the ugly impact of racial incidents in baseball.
That's what he counseled Robinson, and that's how he wrote. He wrote it like, you know what, we're supposed to be here, we belong here, let's act like we belong here, and let's act like anything that happens to us, we can handle it.
Describe what he looked like.
Wendell had, you know, big glasses, and, you know, he was a slightly built man, and just kind of blended in. He wasn't loud, and he wasn't abrasive, and it was interesting, I'm describing him mostly from the one photo I've seen of him and from is what his wife has told me, because nobody really knew what Wendell looked or sounded like because they didn't take pictures of sports writers back then.
He did later become an on-air sports broadcaster for WGN, right?
15, 20 years later, yes, he became an on-air person. By then, he was a very huge figure in the African-American community and as far as in the media. He also, in Chicago, Wendell Smith also wrote a series of columns that they thought should have won a Pulitzer Prize about how, despite baseball being integrated by the early 60s, spring training was still segregated. Players could play on the teams, but in the spring training in Florida, they had to live in separate hotels, in terrible hotels. So he did a huge series about that, changed baseball. Baseball stopped going to those spring training sites in Florida that would not let blacks and whites live in the same place.
Even though they didn't hang out after Jackie's brilliant career, they still remained tied.
The last story Wendell Smith wrote, he was suffering from cancer, and the last story he wrote was from his hospital bed. He wrote Jackie's obit, and then a month later, Wendell died as well.
Why do you think Wendell gets written out of the story time and time again?
Frankly, I must admit to you, until recently, I didn't know idea of this man's great impact. The producers of the movie told me they didn't know until they studied it. We thought it was Jack against the world. Certainly would not imagine him to be a sports writer.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bill Plaschke covers sports for the Los Angeles Times.
In the street, Jackie Robinson hit that ball. It went zooming across the left field wall. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes.
Coming
Jackie
up, want to file
ball.
A FOIA request in the state of Virginia? Better have a state driver's license. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Air France, the official carrier for Marseille-Provence 2013, European capital of culture. A major attraction of the Provence region are the beaches of Nice and Cannes, which are known for sunbathing, discos, high-end shopping, and restaurants, whereas Antibes and the Cap d'Antibes, about halfway between Nice and Cannes, offer a quieter beach vacation. Tickets and information on daily flights to Nice and Marseille are available at airfrance.us. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create professional websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with news of a crucial Supreme Court decision Monday you probably don't know about. It ruled that states are free to reject Freedom of Information requests from non-residents. This, as you will hear, is bad news for journalists, but it's also bad for everybody who's not a journalist. Case in point, Mark McBurney. He submitted a FOIA request for documents concerning himself from the state of Virginia. Virginia didn't comply, and the court decided unanimously that it didn't have to. Mark McBurney.
I was trying to get their internal documents, which established who committed the negligence in misfiling my child support claim three separate times.
Right. You were living in Australia. Your child was now living with you, so you no longer had to pay child support. In fact, you were supposed to get it.
That's correct. My son moved to Australia, and my ex-wife and I had a deal where I would stop paying her child support, and she would begin paying me child support in conformity with the state of Virginia guidelines. She broke that agreement very quickly, and I filed for child support with the child support agency in Virginia. And they misfiled my application three separate times, which caused a year delay in this process. So that was a year I was paying child support. The net cost to me was about $10,000. And I wanted to get documents which showed who screwed up and why.
And what happened?
They basically did everything they could to keep those documents from me. I filed my request by email. They responded through surface mail, which took about 2.5 weeks to get to me in Australia. They were non-responsive to my very direct request for questions. And by the way, I should note that I was a civil servant and I am an attorney, so I knew how to file a FOIA request and I knew how to follow up. I was their worst nightmare, I think. Eventually, I moved back to Rhode Island. I filed another FOIA request, and they said because I had filed from Australia that any future FOIA requests had to be sent by me back to Australian child support and then forwarded from them to Virginia. And Virginia would answer back to Australia, and Australia would file their response with me.
And that's when you sued, and this thing wound up at the Supreme Court.
Exactly right.
You lost.
Yes.
Will you ever get restitution?
No, I won't get restitution. That ship has sailed, as they say. I'm marginally hopeful that I can still get the documents. There was a one-sentence statement by Justice Alito in the opinion that says if Virginia has information on a person, that person should be able to get it. I'm looking forward to seeing how Virginia responds to my request.
We're interested in this because it seems to pose a danger to journalism. But it seems like you don't have to be a journalist to be concerned about this.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And the court oral arguments focused on what they termed a slight delay, that journalists and business people who were looking for public records could simply hire a surrogate in Virginia to make the request on their behalf. But I can't hire a surrogate because the information I'm requesting is germane only to me. So someone in Virginia can't ask for Mark McBurney's child support records. Only I can. So my options are either to file suit or to establish Virginia residency. And that seems very unfair to me.
Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Mark McBurney is a Rhode Island attorney. So while federal Freedom of Information requests can't be ignored, state FOIA requests can. But reporting, especially investigative reporting, often crosses borders. So many news outlets, including the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Daily Caller, and Bloomberg, filed an amicus brief against Virginia's public records rule. Also among them, the Reporters' Committee for Freedom of the Press. The committee's Mark Caramanica says the rule could hobble a lot of vital work.
Say a reporter in Colorado wants to do some sort of 50-state survey, see how states are stacking up on a particular issue against each other, Virginia would not have to honor his FOIA request.
Are these hypothetical examples or actual examples?
Oh, no, these are real stories that were reported. For example, USA Today did a story where they compared how the No Child Left Behind initiative was impacting teacher behavior in a variety of jurisdictions and pulled records dealing with whether teachers were disciplined for potentially coaching students and, you know, trying to cut corners on the standardized tests and so forth to boost up their scores. That was a case where, you know, you need access to Virginia records, obviously, to put Virginia in the mix. ProPublica did a story where they investigated dialysis centers all across the country their effectiveness and safety records and so forth. To get that national perspective, you need Virginia. And, you know, it leaves a hole in the entire story and the complete picture, but it also shortchanges citizens of Virginia because they don't get the benefit of knowing where their state stacks up on certain issues.
The Virginia statute does include an exception for out-of-state and foreign news organizations that serve Virginia. Well, every single news organization lives online. They all can serve Virginia. So doesn't that make this moot?
Well, we don't know, because that media exception to the law talks about newspapers that circulate within the Commonwealth and broadcasters that broadcast their signals within the Commonwealth. A literal reading of that provision does not incorporate online news.
Now, in his decision for a unanimous court, Judge Samuel Alito wrote, quote, requiring non-citizens to conduct a few minutes of internet research in lieu of using a relatively cumbersome state FOIA process cannot be said to impose any significant burden. I mean, is he right? Can't a reporter just do a little clicking to get to this information? I mean, if the stuff is public, it's public.
A large majority of government records and records that journalists would be interested in aren't necessarily posted on the internet, particularly if it's a controversial record that the government would otherwise not have made public. So in many cases, you do have to make that FOIA request.
I mean, Alito is right when he says it is relatively cumbersome. It does cost staff time and money.
You know, each state has a FOIA law set up and a system in place already to preserve records. Those costs are fixed and there no matter what. And in Virginia, you know, if there is a request from out of state, they're allowed to charge additional fees to comply with that request as they would any other request that came in. So the idea that it's somehow taxing the state in some way is somewhat disingenuous.
Can't journalists make an end run around this decision by using one of these services that help people file FOIA requests? You could just go to one of these services in the state of your choice, say Virginia, and have them file it for you.
Well, and this is one of the things that I think it was Chief Justice Roberts pointed out at oral argument. He said, you know, can't you essentially just find a straw man in the state to make the request? And they acknowledge that, and it sort of points out the folly of it. Well, then what's the point of having this restriction? And there are many records where the government's going to fight you on it, and you're going to have to possibly take that to court. So the question becomes, well, then who pursues that? Is it the straw man's responsibility? Is he's the person that really was going to have probably legal standing to pursue that? I'm not sure that's what they're signing up for when they offer to make a request for you to take it to court and litigate it for you.
With a handful of states having rules like this, in practical terms, how much will this affect the information that Americans get?
We were fearful of a Supreme Court announcement that says to all 50 states that, hey, it's okay to discriminate in your FOIA laws. Like I talked about, it does frustrate the free flow of communication when there's something going on in another jurisdiction, and it could be right across the river from your local town, and you as a resident of another state can't get access to that information. That hurts journalism.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Caramanica is the Freedom of Information Director for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Recently, the Supreme Court also heard a case regarding the patenting of genes, specifically two genes named BRCA1 and BRCA2, related to cancers of the breast, ovaries, and the fallopian tubes. The genes have been patented by a company called Myriad, and the High Court's decision, expected by midsummer, could end those patents and others like them. But whatever that decision, certain vital genetic information already is privately owned. For instance, information that Myriad has collected for 17 years about BRCA 1 and 2. We're talking about tens of thousands of data points about what mutations in those genes might mean. So, if you're a woman worried about breast cancer and your doctor takes a genetic sample, he pretty much has to send it to Myriad, because only Myriad can draw from the tests of all those other people to give you an informed answer about your odds of getting the disease. Well, a geneticist named Robert Nussbaum at the University of California, San Francisco, wants to break Myriad's monopoly on its information by getting access to those tests and making public Myriad's interpretations of those tests.
When you analyze a gene like BRCA1 and 2, you find variants. And if these variants are found, we still don't know whether that difference matters. Is it a difference that puts somebody at a 8-fold higher risk for developing breast cancer in their lifetime? And interpreting what a variant means is at the core of doing genetic testing and interpretation.
And Myriad is in the best position to do that because it has the most information about those variants.
Exactly. They've been collecting information over many, many years. And then as of approximately 2006, they decided to no longer share the variants and their interpretation of those variants with the public.
They've collected 17 years of information. Why did it suddenly take the last 7 years of information out of the public domain?
They say that they took it out of the public domain because they thought the information was being misused for clinical purposes. And I find that a very difficult explanation because the information is being not misused, used all the time in clinics to make very serious decisions about medical care. My interpretation of why they closed it is they started to see the timeline of when their patent would either be overturned or would expire, and they felt that by keeping this as intellectual property, they would still be able to claim that even though you could have the test done in any laboratory, why would you want to have it done anyplace else because we have the best data to interpret these results?
And that interpretation led essentially to your Howard Beale moment, and you decided that Myriad's monopoly on this test simply wouldn't do. So you took on a multi-million dollar company with a 17-year head start. How?
But a lot of the testing is being done in large clinics. So I went to these clinics, most of which are run by cancer genetic specialists like myself, and I explained to them all I wanted was Myriad's reading of the sequence. What did they find? Is there a variant or not? And how did they interpret that variant? Put that in the public domain so that other laboratories can look at that database and say, oh, so they interpret it that way. Well, we found the same variant, and we don't think that that's really what that variant means. I wonder who's right. The whole point is to have a community of molecular geneticists analyzing this data and deciding, almost as a crowdsourced curation, what do we think these variants mean?
Okay, so these variants in the gene that can indicate possibly one's potential for developing cancer, how many of them do you think there are?
Oh, there are tens of thousands. These two genes are very large.
So you've been at this now for about a year, and you've gotten doctors and clinics to send you how many tests?
So far we've gotten about 3,000 reports, of which 1,000 are unique variants, and they are in a public database, a U.S. government website run by the National Library of Medicine, with Myriad's interpretation of those variants. What will happen now is that I and some of my colleagues will start getting on the telephone and calling some of the largest clinics in the country, places like MD Anderson, Moffitt Cancer Hospital, Sloan Kettering. They have thousands and thousands and thousands of tests that they've done since 2006. They have all that information in an electronic database. All they need to do is strip the identifier out and send me the Excel spreadsheet. So I think with a couple of dozen more phone calls, I can get another 50,000 variants.
That's pretty awesome.
I have no doubt.
Give me an example, if you can, of how the sharing yields results. Is there a concrete case you can cite?
Sure. Very recently, one of my colleagues had a large family with inherited colon cancer, which looked a lot like a syndrome called Lynch syndrome due to defects in a set of genes that are called mismatch repair genes. She sent the test off to a company. The company happened to be Myriad. And the result came back negative. No disease-causing mutation found. She looked at the family history and she said, I don't believe it. So she arranged for another member of that same family to go get testing done at another laboratory. They found an abnormality. Mm-hmm. Then went back to Myriad and said, are you sure? And they went back and they checked, and indeed the variant was there. The whole idea here is having the ability to have second opinions. Myriad has its own way of interpreting variants. I'm sure it's very good, but it's not as good as all of the minds of the world thinking about what those variants mean.
Most people look at the Supreme Court hearings as an opportunity for real change when it comes to the private ownership of what we're made of. Is that what this means to you?
Well, I think there's a philosophical or humanist side of this that I think is very important. But my real focus is on delivering medical care. Let me give you an example. Suppose every radiology department in the country took x-rays, interpreted their results, and kept them private to themselves. There were no publications showing, you know, this spot on a lung or that spot on a liver and how that was interpreted and what the follow-up was that showed that indeed that spot was a this or a that. How much progress would we have made in interpreting CAT scans or MRI scans under that circumstance? I see this as being very analogous. I don't like to sit down across from a patient and say to them, well, we tested your gene. We found this variant. I don't know what it means. And they say, but why did you even bother to do the test? And my answer is, I didn't know that that was the result we were going to get before we ran the test. And now I've introduced a huge amount of worry into this patient's mind without being able to satisfy it one way or the other. I can't tell them what it means. So it happens to me pretty much every week. I just don't think that's the way I want to practice medicine.
Dr. Nussbaum, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Geneticist and Dr. Robert Nussbaum. A confession. We've excoriated other media outlets for not asking doctors about their potential conflicts of interest, but we failed to ask Dr. Nussbaum. Instead, after our interview, he told us. He wrote, quote, I want to make sure you know that I'm also serving as a paid consultant for Complete Genomics, involved in developing whole genome sequencing. I am paid for my work as a consultant, but the payments are submitted to the University of California and are used by the university to help pay my university salary. I don't garner any additional money for that work. Complete Genomics does not currently provide breast cancer sequencing or any clinical sequencing services at all, but could do so in the future. There you have it, he wrote. Don't say you weren't warned. We also got a statement from Myriad, which you can find on our website, onthemedia.org. Coming up, Cyndi Lauper's many, many, many true colors. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Week, the Broadway musical Kinky Boots swept the nominations for the Tony Awards with 13. Among them, for Best Direction by Jerry Mitchell, Best Book by Harvey Fierstein, and Best Score by Cyndi Lauper. The New York Times noted that if she wins, she'll become the first woman ever to win solo in the category. The musical's based on the 2005 British movie about a real-life struggling shoe factory that finds new life in producing quality boots for transvestites, which makes perfect sense as a subject for Lauper, not just because of her advocacy of LGBT issues, but because it hits yet again the guiding theme of her life, as recounted in her new memoir and her work since her emergence as a pop artist in the 80s. Be whoever you choose to be, a simple message tough to carry out, which she knows all too well. Recently, I had a long conversation with Cyndi Lauper before a live audience in the green space here at WNYC, and we started by playing the video of the song that introduced her to the world.
The phone rings in the middle of the night, my boy.
Captain,
you know what you're gonna do with your life. Oh, Daddy, do you know you're still number one? But girls, they wanna have fun.
Show, are they watching it too?
The people listening to the webcast are watching it and can watch it in perpetuity. But you didn't really want to sing that song, did you?
Not in the beginning, because, you know, it was written by a guy, and of course a guy's not going to sing about what I'd want to sing about. There's a guy, could you imagine? So, you know, when he said, you know, Father dear, we are the fortunate ones, you know, my little rebel heart took issue with it.
We have a little snippet of Robert Hazard's Bowie-esque original.
Know, there is something cool about this that nobody else ever heard. Rick Chertoff collected these songs and was looking for a singer. He didn't know he was going to get me. You know, it's like a dress. You go to the department store, you try on a dress. Let me tell you, not every dress fits good on you. Same with a song. You put a song on, you have to know the story that you are telling. You have to come from a place where you own the story because you know it. And when you connect to it and you tell the truth, you will resonate the truth to a listener. And when it came to girls, I couldn't get girls to sit right. Rick said to me, listen, he said, think of what it could mean if you sang it. And I thought about it.
You wrote that you had the faces of a lot of sad women in your head when you were reconstructing that song. And it's not by accident that your mom was in the video. She was caught in the kind of trap that you didn't want to be in.
It wasn't just me. If you look at all the women of that time, or even women now who still struggle all over the world, you don't always get the fair shake that everybody thinks you get. In fact, you get a half a handshake, basically. And I just felt like, when he said, think of what it could mean, I saw my grandmother, I saw my aunt, and I saw my mother. These were women that were disenfranchised. You got to understand, my family came from Sicily. In Sicily, they don't look at women like an opportunity for a life. They look at women as two opportunities. You marry a morph to somebody wealthy, or they stay home as free domestic help. You know, they don't go out and get educated. They weren't allowed to write, you know, stories. So I did it. And when I did it, I made sure I got as many multiracial girls as I could in the lineup so that no matter where it played in the world or the country, any little girl of any color could look at themselves and see themselves and know that they too should have a joyful existence and are, you know, entitled. And we did it under the guise of fun while we were all laughing and I was the big idiot. The big thing was, everybody, every woman is entitled, not just some. So I felt proud that we were able to get by the gatekeepers, you know?
You left Ozone Park at 17. You stuffed a change of underwear, an apple, and a book in a paper bag.
Yes, and a book called Grapefruit.
So by Yoko Ono.
Yes, it changed my life. The Beatles, Joni Mitchell, the Rolling Stones, the Sly and the Family Stone, all those wonderful songs that helped me exist. And my mother's beautiful books, you know, she always had the Rubaiyats of Omar Khayyam. You know, she took us to see Shakespeare at the Delacorte Theater. She never took us to see Broadway. She thought it was too expensive. But I learned all her records because that's what I sang. At 4 years old, I played The King and I every day, so much so that and I knew every word and every breath and every character. My grandmother came from upstairs. She walked downstairs, opened the door, took the record off of the little red record player, went back upstairs with it without saying a word. And then when Funny Girl happened, she gave up.
I know that you were hitchhiking around. You had to train yourself how not to be hungry. You had some bad experiences.
Yeah, but I did not want to have success on somebody else's terms. Everything I wanted to do, I wanted to own it. I wanted it to be mine.
You wrote in your book that from the very start, you were hell-bent on mixing art and music, the visual and the sound and the story. I wanted to be larger than life, to look completely different. I wanted to be a painting.
I am still a painting. They painted me for hours.
Do you feel a kinship at all with Lady Gaga?
Well, I think that she grew up watching me and Madonna and Annie Lennox and Boy George, and I think all of it influenced her, and also she was an art major.
Madonna emerged just a little bit after you, and her record company and the media tried to cook up some kind of rivalry.
Well, you know, it's always that way with women. They always have to pit one against the other. You know, not very imaginative, is it? And I didn't like to be pit against another woman. I couldn't do that. And I just felt kind of lost because I thought they appreciated my art. And all of a sudden, it was this contest. And I just felt like, you know, I want to make great music. And I want to kick some butt. And she was a wonderful businesswoman who never, I don't know that she really got into fights with anyone. She was much smarter, where I lost my allies and I said like all the wrong things to the right people. And I never explained how I felt. I would find myself in situations and be like, yeah, well, you know, F you. I can't say that, can I? It's public radio.
We can bleep it.
Well, I just said F.
Oh, that you can totally say.
All right, so...
But we'll bleep it anyway, just so it sounds more authentic.
Well, you know, like the first record company I went to, I mean, that's why it probably took so long. I was signed by this German company. They said to me, we're going to make you into the next Streisand. And I looked at them, I said, what do you want to do that for? I said, what kind of lobotomy do I need? I said, listen, why don't you find somebody else and do that? And I think everybody at the table choked because he happened to be the president. But you know what? If you can't be honest, why do you want to live a life where, and why would you suffer so long to finally get to a place where you couldn't tell the truth and be yourself? In the arts and in music, you know, everybody said, well, what happened to music? Yeah, what happened to music? It became full of shit. It became not truthful. In the 80s, all those crazy outfits and hairdos, yeah, they were rough and wild and weird. But it originated with the people who were singing and performing. It originated with the performers. And there's some idiot come in and say, well, I don't think you should do that. You know, somebody told me, they said, oh, I think your makeup, it shouldn't be like that. And I'm thinking to myself, that's right. Biatch, as soon as you're at it. And then it just, from then on, it became war paint. That's what turned me around. You know, 1989, they used to say to me, well, what the hell is that you're wearing? Why can't you wear jeans and a t-shirt like Katrina and the Waves? I'd be like... Oh, my God.
You weren't walking on sunshine?
I wanted to take some sunshine. You know, the problem was that they also threatened you Because George Michaels, when he tried to get out of the contract, they sued him and said they were going to tie up his career, and look how his career is ruined. You will be ruined. They always threatened me with ruination. And after a while, when I was ruined, I figured, hey, I could do whatever the hell I want now, because, you know, once you're on the bottom, what are they going to do? Put another nail in the coffin? Obviously, it didn't work, did it? Because I keep coming back, so what the hell?
What always struck me about your singing, the whole honest thing that you do, is its fearlessness and its generosity. And I found this 1985 clip of you with Patti LaBelle.
Flashback, warm nights, almost left behind. Suitcase of memories, time after time, you picture me. I'm falling to our head. You're calling to me. And hear a word you said that you said.
I wish I could play the whole thing. It's pretty.
Truthfully, when I heard her sing Time After Time, I cried. Inside, I felt like, well, it's one of the greatest voices ever, and she's singing one of my songs. And I was always told, you know, I had to fight so hard to get my own songs on my own record, because I was told that I wasn't a good enough writer. And I was always told most of my life that a woman with a big voice sings, not writes. And then Mariah Carey came along, and she gave one four. Good for her.
After that, obviously it was smooth sailing, except for the bankruptcy and losing your voice. And
my path was never like anybody else's, even after I freaking became famous, when I thought, okay, now it's easy street. The easy street I have not found, except for when Harvey Fierstein called me up, and I just finished a punishment tour, which I thought, oh, do rough riding, go to Europe, doesn't matter, get on a smelly, stinky bus, you know, sweat, be grungy. I don't like dirt. So when Harvey called me and he said, do you want to write for me? This was Harvey Fierstein, who is a great storyteller. I admire him so much. And he called me and asked me if I wanted to write for him. Of course I said yes. It's been an unbelievable experience for me. And I chased over the whole world. And I felt like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, you know, the lion, the tin man, and the scarecrow. I had all three of them walking me through, Steve Arimus, Jerry Mitchell, and Harvey Fierstein, you know who's who. And I realized at the end, after I chased the whole world, what I should have just looked at was my own backyard, because Broadway is a very comfortable place for me.
Kinky Boots. It's based on the British film about an old school shoe company passed down three generations. It's going under. The son can either fire the employees he grew up with or reinvent the company. What they have to do is find a niche market.
And he happens to bump into Lola, a drag queen being attacked, and she had pulled off her shoe and said, I can handle the likes of these guys, and knocks them out with her shoe. And then he told her later on, oh, I could fix this, cheaply made. She's, no, expensive shoes, cheaply made, Lola said. So he went back, and he was still struggling, and all of a sudden he realized the niche market was sitting right in front of him on the chair. He could make a kinky boot, you know, or a boot. He didn't know how kinky yet. You know, it's a development thing
for
him.
Yeah, that goes on. Now let's play
Step
the revelation.
One.
Step one.
Are they going to see this?
Yes.
On the radio?
No.
It's time for a shake up. Look at me, wake up. Taking control. This is a new beginning. My gears are spinning. Let's rock and roll. Just put one foot onward and forward. I used to be a zero, but now I clearly feel that I may be the hero who reinvents the heel. I may be facing the impossible. I may be chasing after miracles. And there may be the steepest mountain to overcome. But this is step one. Yeah, this is step one.
A member of the audience asked, what were her sources of inspiration over the years?
Doesn't matter. You know, it comes from someplace excellent. Who cares? You know, just be open to anything. Because when you're creating, it feels bigger than yourself. And it's better to be involved with things that are bigger than yourself sometimes. And also you have to always, always remember, and I'm me too, I'm like a bully. I have to remember kindness and generosity. And with that, things come. Knit, for goodness sakes, if it makes you feel good. Do creative things. It feeds the other side of your brain. You know, do any kind of music. Play a freaking instrument. It's joyful. It's joyful. It makes you feel better. I play a dulcimer because them open fifths when you strum it, it's so soothing. You know, it's just soothing. And, you know, that's scientific because there's a doctor that worked in maybe Creedmoor. No, not Creedmoor. Bellevue. And he worked with tuning forks. I got them tuning forks, and they have the open fifths, very soothing. So I thought, oh, it's scientific.
Perfect.
My conversation with Cyndi Lauper lasted more than an hour. What you just heard is a heavily edited construction based on a wide-ranging journey through her mind and heart, with stops in the recording studio, various churches, grunge fashion, the music industry, reality TV, her mother's womb, the White House, and much, much more. Plus video. To take it all in, go to OnTheMedia.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Murray, Krista Ripple, and Doug Anderson. We had more help from Alexandra Hall and Ravenna Koenig. And it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.